Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck, along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend edition. Also your hosts throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, Corlin Economics Report. This week was just full of commentating and covering the continued downtrend and just weak markets that we are seeing really across every sector. Throughout this weekend show, we will touch on this weakness, but we're also going to try to take a more big picture look at where markets could go from here and where a reasonable stopping point might be. We're kicking off the show with a good friend of the show, Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago. Now, Dana, we've chatted for a couple years now, and quite frankly, over the last six months to a year, you've been spot on playing these markets, riding the wave higher, and then pivoting when you thought stuff got overvalued more at the end of last year. And you've been calling this pullback correctly, almost perfectly in my eyes. To me, though, it seems like this pullback has been almost too orderly. Some people are saying, oh, this is 2008 again, but we haven't had these big shocks to the system in terms of big events where companies are going bankrupt and markets are going limit down. It seems like just a consistent stair-stepping pattern lower. What's your takeaway from this environment where the Fed's getting the blame, but again, there isn't one individual, it seems like, event that we can point to that's causing all of this weakness?
Yeah, that's right. Thanks a lot, Corey. As we spoke about earlier, this type of action has all the earmarks of one thing, and that's a bear market, like a protracted bear market, not just like a flash in the pan or a quick correction where you've got hot money that just flips short or flips out of the market and panics, and it's enough of a washout, a quick washout, and then all the dip buyers come in and the Fed puts in place, of course, and you rebound quickly, you V-bottom, you go back up. This sort of relentless drip lower day after day without that kind of a washout, like short-term washout, panic-driven type of plunge, this is more symptomatic of a longer-term protracted bear market where it's going to take a while on a longer-term basis to kind of scare people, to get people out of the market, to get people to give up, to get people to, throw their hands up and pretty much give up. And from a long-term perspective, there's still a ton of excess left in the system. This is probably closer to the start, which sounds weird, closer to the start than the end of a longer-term type of corrective action. Because if you look at the longer-term metrics, the background indicators that we talk of, they're not really timing type of indicators, but longer-term metrics like household investments in stocks, equity valuations, long-term long-term price versus trend metrics on the stock averages. All this stuff was at all-time highs, a couple months ago. That's just beginning to correct. And as we've spoken about before, things that go to excess in one direction usually go to excess in the other direction. So we would expect this thing to be, drag out for a long time before those excesses turn into extreme on the other end of the spectrum and put the markets in position where we can put in a durable secular type of a bottom. That's a long way out. I will say the good news after that dose of sober news, from a short-term perspective, I would say, nothing, it doesn't go straight down. I would say we're very close to maybe a good tradable bottom. So I will leave you with that instead of all the bad news. But I would caution after that type of a bounce or a intermediate term bounce back, I would say it's probably going to be more of a selling opportunity than a buying opportunity.
Yeah, Dana, that's kind of what I was going to ask you, because and I think you set it up well there. Like when we saw the 2008-2009 great financial crisis, while it was shocking to the world, you know, it was because of the housing bubble bursting, and it did kind of have a V-shaped recovery where, yeah, it was brutal, but then it also shot to the upside really strong for the next few years. And then the 2020 pandemic crash, people were saying that was a bear market. It's like, you know, it only lasted a month. It was almost over before it started. So that really was a V-shaped snapback. But in a real bear market, where it's a secular bear market like you're discussing, there will be these points where there are relief rallies. And generally, those relief rallies will be something that you'd want to maybe make a quick short side trade on once they bounce up to resistance. So how will you be playing those relief rallies within the bear market?
Sure. Just touch on your point. You look at that COVID crash in 2020, or even look at the crash of 87. Those were not secular bear markets. Those were short-term, very painful corrections, but they snap back almost immediately. If you talk about 2008, 2009, you have to remember stocks topped out, depending on what market cap you're looking at, anywhere from May to October of 2007. So we had been drifting down for a year before all of that, the ugliness that hit in October of 2008. So we were drifting down. Same thing in really 2000. Most stocks topped out in 1998. The large caps topped out in 2000 and drifted lower into 2002 when we finally had some climactic type waterfall plunges. So I think that's what we're in store for. So we're probably going to drip lower before some climactic type of event, maybe a year or 2 years out. I don't know when that will be, but for now, it's more of the earlier stages of a secular bear market. But to your question, you will get those short to intermediate term extreme washout type readings on a short term basis in sentiment, in breadth, in kind of price action. And it's helpful to watch, you know, price levels in the beginning of bear markets. At the end, you get these overshoots, but in the beginning, it often is constructive to if you've got the good analysis to pick out your levels, because it will kind of stair step down, like you mentioned at first. So I would say we are close to some levels where we'll more aggressively cover our shorts and play for that long bounce, maybe for a month or a couple months potentially in stock. So I think we're very, very close to that. You look at, for example, the new lows on the exchanges. If we get a washout day today, if we get a very ugly close, we very well might set a record for most new lows in a day on the NASDAQ. You know, there's a lot of more issues traded than it used to be. It might not be a record for percentage of new lows, but we might set a record for most new lows. And that's, you know, one of those signs we'd be looking for to put in an intermediate term bottom, a good tradable bottom. So we'd cover a lot of shorts on that, probably put on some trading longs. But like you mentioned, there is a ton of resistance now up above just because of all the levels that have been broken. All the former support now becomes resistance. So you have kind of an air pocket we can work through quickly to get some quick gains on the upside. But like you mentioned, those will be trades only. And it'll also be a good chance if you're stuck in some things that have broken down that maybe used to be good technical longs that are not any longer, that'll be a good time to kind of take out the trash, as we would say.
So the early stages of a true bear market, and a bear market that might be unlike any that we've seen in a couple decades, then is anything safe then, Dana, outside of maybe some tradable bounces? Are there any sectors during a prolonged grinding bear market that can do well?
Once you get into the meat of the bear market, no. You look at the defensive names that have held up pretty well, and they can do so. Generally, they can continue to make higher highs and higher lows. When you get into those climactic type ends of either short-term moves or the ends of the long-term, then nothing is safe. They'll take everything out and shoot it. So there's nowhere to hide except cash, you know? You can play, certainly, if you're nimble, if you're, you know, an active advisor like we are, you can certainly attempt to play the short side, which we have done pretty aggressively this year, and try to pick up games. Obviously, that's not recommended for you know, amateurs out there. But other than that, a good place to put your monies in cash, because nothing in that, like I said, in the meat of a bear market, nothing is safe. And what makes this one potentially more devastating for the investment community at large is the damage that's being done to the bond market. We were in the last several secular bear markets, you know, in the 2000s, the bond market was still in a great bull market, which pretty much, I think, from our perspective, probably ended in 2020, and we're probably seeing rates go up for several decades to come, potentially. In that case, if bonds are not a place to hide and we're seeing the flip of both stocks and bonds, then that's going to make things particularly tough for even so-called conservative investors, older investors who think their portfolios are conservative. I saw a chart from, I think it was Merrill Lynch the other day that said the typical 60-40 portfolio is on track for its worst year ever. It's on pace for a minus 50% year. So if you think you're like in some sort of a conservative type of portfolio, a balanced portfolio, and you're not aware of the fact that bonds are likely in a secular bear market as well, it's going to be not just shocking, it's going to be devastating for those types of investors who think they're at least they might be losing money, but bonds are going to cushion the blow, because they're not going to cushion the blow this time.
I think that's an excellent point, Dana, and something that a couple of other guests have mentioned as well, that 60-40 model has really been blown up now, and we've really seen the end of the 30 to 40 year run in bonds, which means we've seen the low in rates. And as you point out, if rates keep going higher and if bonds keep going lower, a lot of people's retirement plans, when they're not checking the markets every day, are going to start showing quarterly statements that are less than stellar. But one place people are hiding is cash. And when you look at the US dollar, I'd love to get your thoughts on it. It's really ratcheted higher from when you think from where it was just a year ago in the low 90s to where it is now, 104.87 as we record this. What is your take on the dollar? Is it getting top heavy here, or can it just keep blasting higher?
No, the trend is up. You have to be bullish on the dollar still. We spoke, I think, a couple of weeks ago when the dollar ran up to 104. We said might be some temporary resistance, because we're running into peaks from the couple of years prior, which were honestly the highs for the past two decades for the most part. Now we're breaking through today. Up close to 105. So those are like almost multi-decade highs. So there, you cannot be bearish the dollar right here. I think there's upside right now in the immediate term after this breakout up towards that 110 level might be the next level to look for potentially a pause.
All right, Dana, we'll wrap it up here. Boy, oh boy, I wish there was a bit more positivity for these markets. But look, you've been spot on with your calls, and this is already, it seems like, a different sort of bear market that we've experienced over the last couple of decades, because the last few have come on so quick and have really been driven by one, maximum two singular events that started the downfall. This one, man, there's a lot of negativity out there because people everywhere are losing money, and it's that grinding nature that's killing everybody. Dana, thank you, as always, for your time, man. I really appreciate your insights on these markets. We'll chat again in another couple weeks. Keep up the good job, Dana. Really appreciate it.
Sounds great. Always a pleasure, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this segment, we are chatting with Jayant Bhandari, private investor and consultant to many large resource investors, well-known resource investors. Jayant, we're going to get right into it here because, look, we've been talking about how much the junior resource stocks, especially the junior precious metal stocks, have lagged the much higher prices really across the board in commodities. Even though resources, commodities have pulled back from some of their highs, look, these juniors didn't really seem to react to any great degree in the last year and a half. And then on top of that, right now, they're getting absolutely crushed. We're seeing juniors back to trading at cash in the bank valuations, while some of them have ongoing drill programs. Even ounces in the ground aren't getting valued highly at all in tier one jurisdictions. Giant, we're sitting at over 1800 for gold, and these juniors are trading like gold's back at almost $1,000. What's your takeaway from this environment where juniors just can't get off the mat and get any value for anything that they're doing?
Thanks for having me, Corey. Corey, I have been in the industry for about 15 to 17 years, and what I have seen is that I don't make any money for 2, 3, 4 years, and suddenly within a year, I more than make up for all the losses I will have made in those 3 or 4 years. So I think what people have to be, I want to make sure for myself is that I don't take too much margin, or I don't take margin at all. I invest in companies that I really understand thoroughly, and then don't worry about changes in share prices. If I invest for value, eventually I hope, and usually it does happen, that the value gets recognized by the market. Over the last few days, share prices have fallen so much, mostly because volume has fallen drastically in the venture exchange. If you look at the volume in the Canadian venture exchange from mid-April onwards, the volume has fallen by about 50%. And if you look at the spread between share prices of companies, these days you often see a massive spread, which could be as much as 30 to 40% between bid and ask prices. So that means that the buyers have disappeared from the market, and this really gives people like me an opportunity to give stink bids and buy things very cheaply.
Well, Giant, it's interesting to note the very low volumes, because it does seem to indicate that there's not a lot of buyers, but there's also not a lot of sellers. It seems like there could be some selling exhaustion soon. But one thing that strikes me as just startling is, if people think back to where gold was trading when it was at 1800 or so, a little bit north of that back in 2011, and the valuations that companies have, and then fast forward to 2016, where gold only got up to maybe the mid 1300s, and where the silver and the gold stocks were trading then, even now at $1,800, you know, north of that for gold and north of $22 for silver, we're still seeing valuations that are lower than at those two prior periods, even lower than last year when it felt like we were stuck at 1800 forever. The valuations weren't this low. So what's interesting is there hasn't anything fundamentally changed with a lot of these companies. If anything, they have bigger work programs, more going on. They've made more progress. They've drilled more meters, and they are just in the hurt locker. People thought it was cheap last year, and people were saying it was cheap in 2017 and 2018, but now it's really cheap. So at what point is it a value trap?
Well, I don't consider the current market to be a value trap. I think this is truly a great opportunity to invest in the market. Now, of course, Shad, I would have said exactly the same thing to you last year as well, which would have meant that I would have made a lot of loss in the last 1 year, and I have. But as I said earlier, you have to invest for value. You have no other option. You can't look into the future, and once you think you have invested for value, all you can do is to wait patiently for the market to recognize the underlying value of these companies. Now, look at one company, Gran Colombia, a company that I have talked with you in the past. Now, they are generating a nice cash flow of, I think, about 50 cent American a year. The company is has fallen to... I think about $4.50 or something. So that's the kind of situation that you have in the market, where companies have fallen far too much, despite the fact that they are paying dividends and they have a lot of inherent value.
So Giant, where are you seeing the best value then? Because you can look to some mid-tier miners that are generating some nice cash flow. Those have been sold off. But then you also look to juniors that, to my point earlier, we're seeing ounces in the ground in tier one jurisdictions being valued at
$10 an ounce. They're not getting any value for those either. So then where do you see the best value opportunity in the sector?
I would certainly look for opportunities. Basically, Corey, just about everything is very cheap right now. But you can find a lot more value in illiquid names where the volume is not high. And because buyers have disappeared, the share prices of illiquid companies have fallen a lot more than share prices of liquid companies. So look for companies that are illiquid and see if they have they are solid companies, and then invest in those companies. I think Grand Columbia being one of them. Their warrants are very illiquid. They are trading for about $2.50. And as I said, this company is generating about 50 cents in cash for each share every year.
Giant, that's an interesting point about looking for the illiquid companies. I mean, some would argue that some of them are illiquid for a reason, or maybe it's their management team or asset. But I've also noticed that companies that are doing very little work and are putting out very little news aren't moving as much to the downside as companies that actually are putting out a lot of news. I mean, it depends. It's case by case. But there's a lot of companies that are putting out news, and that news becomes a liquidity event. And we've talked to a lot of companies that said, we don't even know if we want to put out news right now, because every time we do, the market sells. What's your thoughts on that? Or maybe looking at companies that are really sitting more on their hands than being active right now?
Well, Shad, in a desperate situation, people are looking for liquidity to sell what they own. That is indeed true. And this is what we have seen in the past as well. When in a bad market, a good company releases a good news, there's usually a sell-off, which means that the share prices can actually fall after the release of a good news. So this is unfortunately a strange behavior of the market, but I would rather use that as an opportunity to buy those companies rather than sell them.
So Giant, what's it going to take to get some more sentiment into this sector? Because the whole narrative that a lot of the analysts were saying was that gold does well in inflationary environment, and we have still high inflation really around the world. Yes, interest rates are going up. They're still at low levels, and they're still lagging inflation. So that whole argument of negative real interest rates, that should drive metals prices. And metals prices, in all fairness, are doing okay, but the money isn't filtering down into the smaller companies, not even close to filtering down into the mid-cap companies. People have said higher prices brings in more investors. We saw little blips of that, but not enough to actually keep investors in the sector, in the stocks. What's it going to take to change this pretty bad sentiment?
Corey, I don't know what the thinking of the Fed is currently, but I'm reasonably sure they are very afraid of what's happening in the market because the Democratic Party wants to win the next elections in the US. So I am absolutely sure they are afraid of the fall in the market over the last few weeks. I'm hearing from some people that it is indeed possible that they might not increase the rate as aggressively as they have said they would because they are afraid of the market reaction to the increase in interest rates. So I don't know when the market will come to recognize that there's value in the market. But I would think that it should happen sooner rather than later, because a lot of sell-off has happened over the last few days. And my gut feeling is that this has to be the bottom, but who knows, maybe 6 months later, we might still be talking about why the market has fallen further.
Well, Giant, the commodities as a whole, if you look at the energy sector, oil and nat gas, if you look at lithium stocks and uranium stocks, if you look at the base metals, the agricultural products, a lot of them have had a pretty good string of 1 to 2 years of higher prices. Now, the correlating companies that extract those maybe didn't do quite as well. But overall, the commodities had a pretty good run. They've pulled back now. But we are starting to hear more and more people talking about the potential of recession if the Fed goes too far, or stagflation if we have this high inflation paired with maybe some problems in the labor markets down the road. Do you think if we saw something like a period of extended stagflation or even recession down the road, that this would hurt the demand for commodities because we have China locked down, we have some of the big infrastructure bills paused? Where would the demand come from for the commodity sector moving forward?
So Shad, the globalization is broken right now. The supply chains are broken. China has gone completely crazy in terms of trying to control COVID. It makes absolutely no sense to me what they are doing in Shanghai today. I think we are clearly in a situation where we have a stagflation and crisis, social crisis in many parts of the world. Countries like Sri Lanka, they have a lot of problems right now. They have burned down houses of the prime ministers and many ministers of the country. So there's a huge problem in Sri Lanka. There's problem in Peru. There are going to be problems in a lot of countries. Indian rupee is trading for its lowest ever compared to the US dollar today. So we clearly have a situation where we have a stagflation, we have recession, and we have a broken globalization. But I still think that what has been carrying the most weight in terms of growth in the world has been China. And China, once it wakes up from its COVID zero craziness, should be able to recover very quickly. And that should lead to a rapid increase in commodity consumption in China. But that's my hope. I have been extremely optimistic about China for the last 1.5, 2 decades. And I feel sad to see what Xi Jinping has been doing to China in terms of enforcing absolutely crazy lockdowns there.
Yeah, China and the people living there, boy, oh boy, still locked down as the rest of the world is broadly open. Tough environment for them. Giant, if we do start to see a bit of a recovery in China and commodities do start moving a little bit, do you think we're going to start to see some more financings? Because back to these companies, juniors, even though they might be trading for cash in the bank, boy, oh boy, the prospects of raising money right now are not good. We're seeing just a couple financings announced each week, some large financings, but we're not seeing juniors able to raise the type of money that they do so that investors look at them and say, ooh, they're going to be running out of money soon. Where does that environment change, and how do you view that environment when eventually these juniors could run out of money?
Well, you certainly don't want to invest in companies that do not have cash right now. I have seen at least two companies that have fallen by about 30 to 40% compared to what they announced their share financing price as. So one company announced a financing price of $1. It's currently trading at about 60 or 65 cents. Another company closed a financing at $1.25. It's trading at less than 90 cents. So there is a crazy fall in market share prices of some of these companies. And companies that don't have cash are companies that I truly want to stay away from for now.
Well, Giant, another trend talking about raising money is the capital build that companies that are at the development stage or even producers that have a development project are revamping their economic studies and finding out it's going to take a lot more money to get the mine built, to get the cement, to get the steel for the labor. And we've seen a couple companies tank recently when they put out cost overruns that were far above what they had initially announced for their development projects. So how does that bode for the rest of the development sector? And how does that bode for other companies that have projects in their pipeline they'd like to build, but they're going to need to raise hundreds of millions of dollars, sometimes even billions of dollars, to bring these large projects online?
Yes, and that's something that I see at least in one company that I was trying to understand. This company is in its feasibility stage situation right now, and it seems that their capex will go up by 50 to 70% compared to their PEA, which was released a couple of years back. So unfortunately, that is the situation. We have a huge amount of inflation in capex, and we have a huge amount of inflation in operating costs. So we have to be aware of those things. But again, Shad, compared to the share prices of these, compared to what's happening with the inflation and revenue generating capacities of some of these companies, their share prices have fallen far more than they should have fallen.
Do you think that's also because we're not seeing the M&A action to take some of these projects, these multi-million ounce defined resources, off of the market? It's something I've been pointing to for the last while now, is that, look, there are a lot of 1 million, 2 million, 3 million ounce resources that have similar economics, or at least are estimated to have similar economics in good jurisdictions. No longer does 1 million ounces seem to carry the same weight as it used to a decade ago, but we're just not seeing these companies taken out, and that's the end game for a lot of these companies. So it almost feels like a lot of these resources, these deposits, are getting stuck. What do you think about this environment where 1 million ounces isn't the same as it was 10 years ago?
Well, Corey, you know, I have exactly the same feeling. There should be an increase in mergers and acquisitions happening in the market. And I'm not sure why more of those are not happening right now. Is it because the current managements are too entrenched? They don't want to sell their companies. They don't want to negotiate a merger because, of course, some of them will lose their jobs in the process of mergers. But I think mergers have to happen. And if these companies start running out of money and if they can't raise money from the market, then they will have no option but to start merging with those companies that are cash rich and stronger. So I hope that that process starts because without that, there will not be new energy coming into the market. But once that process starts, there will be new blood flowing in the market.
Well, just tying together the two last comments, I mean, I think a lot of the reason that we're not seeing more mergers is because these companies are realizing that there's cost overruns everywhere and that a lot of the projects they were looking at maybe a year ago, and the excuse was, well, we couldn't get to the project because of COVID restrictions on travel. But now they're thinking, boy, I can't go out and announce to the market a big merger when we know it's going to take so much more to build this project than their PEA or their PFS or their FS. And we also hear the narrative that we're going to need more copper. We're going to need more nickel. The world needs more rare earths. The world needs more tin. You know, but to build those projects, it's not just a $50 million or $100 million. It's $1 billion sometimes. So where are those companies going to be able to get the money to build these mega projects to supply these minerals that the world so badly needs? Is there a breaking point where finally people are going to have to either raise the prices to a point where it makes sense to bring them online, or we're going to have a change in the way companies get funded where the terms are a little bit better in favor of the mining companies?
Well, terms in favor of mining companies should not be better. These companies should be generating a nice return on capital invested. I think what should face the consequences of the economic situation is increase in is the commodity prices. Commodity prices should increase to cater to increased inflation, increased prices of capital expenditure, and increased operating costs. So my view is that commodity prices should go up, and we should avoid investing. Managements of these companies should avoid investing unless we see higher commodity prices, such that they make good return for the shareholders at the current share price.
John, kind of on a tangent here, there's a group of companies that is usually doing pretty well this time of the year. That's companies in the Golden Triangle, because they are quickly approaching the time when they can drill. A lot of these companies do still have a fair bit of money and are planning big drill programs, but they are not getting any love heading into these drill programs. What we usually see with Golden Triangle companies is they run for this month, even last month, and maybe a couple more months, and then start to peter out a little bit in the second half of the year. What's the environment for Golden Triangle companies if they're not running this time of the year?
Yeah, I mean, companies should avoid investing money in the ground if the market does not give them value for that investment in the ground, particularly if they are running out of cash. And it's a dilemma. It's if you don't drill, then you can't show results to the market, and your share prices won't perform. So it's a vicious cycle for a lot of these companies. But I think managements have to make common sense decision in which they should invest in the ground only if they can make the market see value that they are creating before they have to raise the next round of money. It's not an easy decision in my view, but that is exactly why I'm not really keen on investing in companies that are running out of cash right now.
Well, Giant, could part of the problem be, and I haven't heard a lot of people talk about this other than every day, and that is the delays at assay labs. We're still getting reports in from people's 2021 drill programs. I probably have seen a half dozen news releases just in the last week or so on people putting out the end of their 2021 drill results. And so they raised capital back in 2020, or maybe the early part of 2021, did this drill program, and we're just now getting the results for it, and they're falling on deaf ears. And so they may usually want to raise on the love that they get from the market on those results. So companies are frustrated that they did all this work, they raised all this money, they drilled these holes, they waited for months, maybe 3 to 6 months, to finally get them back, and then nobody cares. And that's what they needed to fund the next chapter. So is part of it just the massive delay times at assay labs?
Yeah, I mean, we you see the globalization process, the whole value chain is broken right now. Nothing seems to be working. Companies have run out of spare parts. They can't procure spare parts. Farmers don't have access to fertilizer, for example. So we have a broken globalization system. And, you know, there are so many known and unknown problems right now that we will have problems with valuation of companies.
So, Giant, let's summarize this here. What are you doing with your portfolio? Do you have a bunch of stink bids in there? Are you already positioned in the stocks that you like, that you think are getting the least value for their project? Or are you doing something completely different? Give us some insights here, please.
So I have, Corey, clearly used up all the cash I had over the last couple of days. So I really have not much cash left, except that I have some money segregated for a private placement that I will be doing over the next few days. And I have made a commitment for that. So I will be, I have segregated that cash. But apart from that, I simply don't have any cash. But if I had $5 million today in cash with me, I would invest all of that money over the next couple of days. That's how good the market is for investment purposes right now.
All right, Giant, we'll wrap it up here. Look, I am also seeing just a lot of value out there that isn't getting any love in the market. And we have seen these environments before, and these environments can last longer than investors would like. However, they can be great opportunities. It can just feel really weird buying stocks that clearly nobody else is buying and that keep on trending lower. However, the washout that we have seen does set up the potential for a snapback type rally. We'll see where we go from here, but I always appreciate your insights there, Giant. We'll be chatting again in the next couple weeks, and I'll also be seeing you at an upcoming conference in Vancouver. That should sure be interesting to judge the mood of that conference. Giant, thank you, as always, for your time, buddy. It's great chatting with you. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you very much, Chad and Corey.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report, we're going to focus on a couple bigger picture themes here. As we spent the first part of this show talking about the crazy market volatility and what's driving a lot of the weakness across the board, we're going to step back. We are chatting with Axel Merk, President and Chief Investment Officer of Merk Investments. Now, Axel, you recently attended a conference, the Hoover Monetary Conference. There in attendance were some Fed speakers and also some events that you got to go to with some of these Fed heads where you got to ask some questions. And I think you got a couple more insights into the monetary policy and also just what's going through some key heads of the Fed. Axel, can you give us a little summary here? I've never attended this conference, but what were some of the key takeaways that you garnered from that conference?
Yeah, great to be with you, Corey. Well, it's sponsored by the Hoover Institution. And those who know Hoover can imagine that this is kind of a love fest of the hawks, of those who like tougher policy. That said, not all the speakers are hawks, and that's exactly what makes it so interesting, that you have some pretty sharp exchange of views. And Jim Bullard, who used to be dovish and now is all hawkish, he's the St. Louis Fed president, he's the guy who dissented. He spoke quite actively, both in asking questions and being on the panel and whatnot. And I mean, the hawkish view, I think, is well known, that the Fed is behind the curve. Indeed, that was a big theme of the conference. And Jim Bullard explained, yeah, we are very much behind the curve based on these metrics. But if we look at it differently, we're only a little bit behind the curve. And so that was a broad theme. There was a lot of talk about the risk of stagflation as well, a word that people would have scoffed at a while. But what really got me concerned or worried wasn't so much that there were quote-unquote dovish people, but the reasons and arguments that they gave why they think everything is going to be just fine. And if you want me to, I can expand on that a bit.
Well, Axel, I would be interested to hear why they thought it was just fine in the face of 8.5 CPI inflation, and they just got off the mat with their first 0.25% and their 50 basis points. So they've got 0.75% of a percentage point on the Fed funds rate now. But they've never been this far behind the curve, and we're seeing weakness in the markets. We're seeing geopolitical turmoil. We're seeing a slowdown in GDP growth. So how was it that some people thought everything was going to be okay?
Yeah, well, it's the transitory theme, and they don't use that word anymore because that's been poo-pooed on, but that's basically what it is. It's not just these numbers you mentioned. Even if you look at inflation expectations over the next 10 years are now around 3%, which is huge. But the doves shrug it off, saying, yeah, we have high inflation now, but it comes down, and then it just happens to average it at 3%. Then the geopolitical risks, they said, when I asked, well, what about famine around the world because of 30% of wheat exports being off the market, political instability, says, yeah, but that's not going to have any spillover effects to the U.S., and we don't need to worry about it too much. But most importantly, the key dovish argument is that the rates are rising, and the market is pricing in higher rates in a year and two. And that tighter market being priced in down the road is going to be sufficient that everything is going to play out okay. Now, the main argument against that, and the one who articulated it best, was Larry Summers. You might remember him, former U.S. Treasury Secretary, always likes to be a gadfly in things. But what he pointed out is kind of the obvious. We have almost two job openings for each job seeker. This is as hot a job market as it has rarely, if ever, been, which means we have a completely overheating economy, and we simply cannot afford to wait a year until rates are higher. Because the way inflation works, it's not like a light switch that you can turn on and off. And so that is the huge, huge problem that we have. And then so Larry is obviously not on the Fed. He would like to have that job. And then, by the way, he, as you may recall, he was close in the running to be Fed chair several years ago. But since he's quite a polarizing figure, he then didn't make it. But yeah, the dovish view is that things will be all right. And one of the concerns I have, of course, Shad, you pointed out, is with the geopolitical risks we have, not everything is going to be perfect. There is a little potential that something is going to get messed up along the way. And so we just don't have that luxury of hoping for the best. I like to say that hope is not a very good policy.
Hope is not a good policy. But when it comes to the Fed, though, they talk about their dual mandate that deals with employment, also deals with the economy. And the Fed always tries to say, well, we're not paying attention to the markets. That's not part of our job. But they do seem to be. Any takeaways of what is impacting Fed policy the most in your eyes?
Well, it wasn't so much discussed at that conference, but just a quick work on their fear or thought about the markets. What they care about is dislocations in the market. And so the whole idea, of course, of raising rates is to, quote unquote, tighten monetary conditions, to make it more difficult to access funding. And you see that, of course, in mortgage rates, junk bonds should have a higher spread, a higher yield versus regular rates. But what they don't want, they don't want the dislocations. And part of that, you see, I like to refer to the Eurozone. You may remember there used to be a crisis in the Eurozone. And when rates go up, the Italian bonds yield more than the German bonds. But when there's a crisis, then there's a flight into German bonds and a flight out of the Italian bonds. And so that then creates a breakup risk. So translated to the US, you don't want the wheels to fall off the wagon. That's what they're concerned about. They're not too concerned about, oh, yeah, sure, there's a sell-off in the bond market. But you don't want that sort of dislocation. As far as what they were mostly concerned about at the conference, the NOVs weren't terribly concerned, I don't think. They were concerned about the best press they're getting about the high inflation. They do say, yes, they need to hike more, but they are still in this camp. I like to call it amputating a leg by starting with a big toe. That's just not how you amputate a leg. And I'm not a medical doctor, but it does seem to be the wrong way to go about it. And so similarly, at the Fed, it doesn't seem to be the most productive way to gradually raise rates, even if they now do these half percentage hikes.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, Axel, that they're taking off one toe at a time instead of just chopping the leg off. And even if they did 100 basis point hikes four times in a row, we'd still have negative real rates when you and adjust it for inflation. And so, again, as they continue down this road of, let's say, 50 basis point hikes, a lot of market commentators are worried that we're going to see a continued slowdown in growth and persistently high inflation, even if it starts trending lower. Prices are going to remain high. So I know you've brought up the term stagflation. We hear that a lot. We also hear the potential of a recession. We hear some people say it's an inflationary depression, or some people are saying we're now in deflationary forces with a high dollar and the stock market's correcting. Help us make sense of it. Where are we at in this economic theory, Axel?
Well, instability, I think, is the key term here. When what happens is, of course, the Fed is not going to sit there and say, oh, inflation is going to the roof. We're not going to do anything. No, as you see, right? They start talking more. They start hiking a quarter point, then half a point, and they'll do more. But because they're not getting in front of the problem, you're creating this instability in the market. You're creating these gyrations because as they tighten more, as you point out, there's a risk of a recession, and then there's the expectation that they'll reverse course. And so all of that creates an ever more difficult environment, not just for the Fed, but also for investors, as we've seen with the gyrations in the market.
So, Axel, what do you think about this whole concept of stagflation then? Is stagflation here? Is it coming? We hear a lot about it, but we've heard a lot about it over the last decade. What's your take on that?
Well, you and I may have talked about it for a while, but in the mainstream media, it was kind of a word that you were laughed at if you were using it. Oh, it's not the 1970s because the market is so different. We don't need to worry about it. And sure enough, there were several academic presentations at that conference I attended where they talked specifically about stagflation risk. And by the way, the key problem is if you take the 1970s and look at the Dow, because the Dow was kind of the predominant index at the time, it nominally kind of with gyrations kind of went through the later half of the 70s. But on a real basis, when you discount, take out the inflation that was caused, you lost significant amount of money. So it's very, very difficult to hide. And some of the places that you're able to hide in the 70s, and that is presumably a decent place to hide, is real estate. Oil obviously did well, gold did well at the end of the day. And so those sort of things may do well. And of course, nowadays you have inflation protected securities as well. None of that is kind of the perfect solution to any environment, but you can try to at least diversify your portfolio a little bit with some of those. You can look at that and see whether that's worthwhile. But there is no silver bullet. That's the short answer.
Yeah, Axel, a lot of people are wondering where they can go hide to ride out the storm, but we have seen higher energy prices like the 1970s, and we definitely are seeing higher inflation. A lot of people say, hey, it's not nearly as high as it was in the 70s, but it's also coming from where the Fed only wanted 2%, and we've shot way past that now about four times as much. So we do have that component. I guess the piece that people would push back on the stagflation argument is we don't really have high unemployment right now. So how do you think that labor part factors into the equation?
No, I mean, not saying we are smack in the middle of stagflation, but there's a risk of that, of course, right? If the Fed does what they're supposed to be doing, they will slow down the economy. Unemployment has to increase to bring supply and demand into balance. Now, maybe we're quote-unquote lucky that equity markets crash. And all the folks that retired early because they made so much money during the lockdowns are now coming back to the labor force. So that might be a way of rescuing us. So there are obviously different ways that all of this can play out.
Axel, when it comes to the high inflation aspect, how do you view the consumer right now? Because the consumer helped to drive higher inflation when the COVID lockdown started to subside. But now they've run out of the free money that was given to them, and we're seeing higher credit card debt. You would think eventually the consumer, the demand side of the inflation equation, is going to reach some peak.
Well, we see some of that. There's some anecdotal evidence that people are hoarding inventories, right? Because everybody buys so much, it's difficult to get anything. And so in some places, you've hoarded stuff. And now the consumer says, well, I bought enough for the next 2 years. And so that's part of that instability that I'm referring to, right? And then the folks who have that inventory selling it are going to dump it. And so there is going to be a back and forth. And all of that, again, it creates some sort of instability in various markets.
Well, Axel, we also hear about both the demand pull inflation and the cost push inflation. And so the demand coming from the consumers and the buying and the pent-up demand coming out of the pandemic, but also the cost push where the higher commodities prices that we're seeing really across the board, even though they pulled back some, they're still pretty high compared to where they were, let's say, a year or two ago. And companies need to pass those prices along to consumers. So consumers are kind of getting hit on both ends. They're not getting the freebie liquidity from the government. They're seeing higher prices at the gas pump and the grocery store on their services they subscribe to. How much of it is that, or how much of it is the root cause of inflation, which is really excessive liquidity and excessive money supply?
Well, it's excessive liquidity, money supply, a big contributing factor. Fiscal helicopter drop is certainly a big contributing factor. When you write $1,400 checks to people, they're going to spend that money. Right? Not everybody, but those who need that money will spend it on essentials. And that's why the essential goods inflation is there. We have the wage pressures on top of that. So, but yes, it's ultimately what the Fed theoretically should have done is when those checks were written, they should have raised rates. But of course, they didn't. And then they were dragging their heels and waited. And now at least 9 months behind the curve.
Axel, what about other central banks, though? How are they contributing to this overall environment that is potentially leading us towards stagflation?
Well, if there's some good news, is that we have a greater dispersion. We got the Europeans that are still dragging their heels, or at least the Eurozone. There's a lot of pressure that they'll hike, and they might do so in the third quarter, maybe even early in the third quarter. But we've had several central banks around the world hike rates, including New Zealand, Australia, and other places. And so the good news for investors is that we are finally away from being glued to zero everywhere, which also means, of course, we have greater volatility, and not just because the Fed is behind the curve, but simply because there are different opportunities around the world. The age of everything kind of flatlined is probably over.
Well, Axel, as investors get more defensive, some have gone into dividend-paying stocks, some have sought refuge in the U.S. dollar. But you mentioned a couple of those sectors, whether it be, you know, the real estate market, oil and gas, gold, the TIPS protected securities. Do you think that those will be spared if we do get a continued sell everything environment, or will they eventually diverge from the general markets and present a alternate track for investors to take?
Well, for full disclosure, as you know, and some of your listeners may know, we recently launched the Merck Stagflation ETF. It's an exchange traded product where we invest in oil and gold and real estate and inflation protected securities. And the reason we put this ETF together is precisely because we think that might be one way investors can potentially diversify. Now, do we know that these things will do well in the environment that's forthcoming? Of course not. But we have many, many drivers that are supportive of that. And so we engineered a rules-based ETF that mimics some of the things that we had in the 1970s that did well in those days. And we are fully aware that we are, of course, not in the 1970s environment. But there's a reason they did well. And if you take just real estate, for example, the rents will move higher as an inflationary push. And so that will increase the income for those real estate investment trusts, for example. And we're not making an investment recommendation here, but we put an ETF together because we are concerned about what's out there and pretty much to give investors a tool that they have so that they can look at that compared to all the other choices that they have out there.
So Axel, just to bring everybody up to speed, that inflation ETF that you guys just launched trade on the NYSE under the symbol STGF. What's your assessment of the demand for a stagflation product? Obviously, you see an avenue for people wanting to invest in it and an environment for stagflation. What's some of the feedback been?
Well, the feedback has been very good. When we first filed for it, the nerds that look at these filings were all over it. We got some media coverage way before we launched. And now that we're in the market, there are a lot of people talking about it. We obviously, as I mentioned, we see hear Fed officials talk about it. It's the stagflation. They obviously don't tout our product there. But we are the first stagflation-themed ETF. And I am afraid that we may be onto something. So we'll see, right? We'll see what environment we'll be in, and it's something where we believe that investors should have a tool. And so rather than just talk, which many people do, we actually act. We put something together and see whether that's going to be something that investors will embrace. And so far, it looks very much so.
All right, Axel, we'll wrap it up here. Very interesting new stagflationary product. And also, thank you for breaking down what you heard at the Hoova Monetary Conference. So much depends still on the Fed and other central banks around the world, from markets down to the economy and down to individual pocketbooks, thanks to just how active and still free it seems like these central banks are to create money. But boy, oh boy, what a wild year it has been already, and you combine that with the ongoing volatility and, quite frankly, pullback in all asset classes. Not pretty for investors. Axel, thank you for taking time on this weekend show. Everybody, thank you for tuning in on the weekend show. Hopefully next week, a little bit better week for the markets, but boy, oh boy, the trend still seems to be to more of a build cash position than anything. So we'll see what the rest of this month and the rest of this year leads to us. Axel, thanks again for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Have a great weekend.